Just a bit of background, for, especially for those of you who've recently joined this this evening. We're, since last September, our theme for these Tuesday nights has been great Buddhist texts. So we've had a really, really good look at the early scriptures of Buddhism, the Pali Canon, the canon written in the Pali language. We've looked at some of the later, what are called Mahayana scriptures, which are called great vehicle, if you like, scriptures, which is the scriptures from the Buddhism of, the main form of Buddhism in places like China, Korea, Central Asia, Japan, which has a strong emphasis on altruism, on practicing for others and not just for yourself, not just for your own liberation. So we've looked at quite a lot of those scriptures. And now last week we moved on to the third so-called vehicle of Buddhism, the Vajrayana. So yana means something like vehicle or way. Maha means great, so this is a great way. Vajra means diamond or thunderbolt or diamond thunderbolt. So this is the way of the diamond or the way of the thunderbolt. Sometimes also called the Tantra or Tantric Buddhism that we're now looking at. So this is now mainly seen in the Buddhism of Tibet and in one school in Japan, Shingon, this particular style of Buddhism. But it's a sort of approach to the Dharma, which, I mean, we very much take on board. We very much include in our sort of, in our ethos. So tonight we're going to look at a group of texts. So this is about great texts of Buddhism. Tonight we're going to look at a group of texts called termas. We're going to look at the terma tradition of Tibet. Terma means treasure. And I'm going to look at one terma in particular, which is the Bardo Todol, or the usually known in the West as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So I'm going to just describe that in a bit more detail. But I'm also going to look at just the Terma tradition in general. So in the first, if you were here last week, in the first talk on the Tantric tradition, you heard Padmavajra talk about Padmasambhava, who was the person who first successfully introduced Buddhism to Tibet. So in case you weren't there, I'll just sort of sum up very, very briefly. So the king of Tibet, this is, we're talking 8th century now, no, something like that, is that right? The king of Tibet wanted to introduce Buddhism to Tibet, and he invited the gentle, saintly, scholarly Shantarakshita to come to Tibet and establish a monastery. But the demons of Tibet, or if you like, the sort of habitual coarse energies of Tibet and its people, were too powerful. So Shantarakshita, this sort of scholarly, saintly figure, he gave up. He said to the king, I can't do this, king. I can't do this. These demons are too much for me. But I know who can. He's called Padmasambhava, and his current address is a cremation ground somewhere in India. So they sent off for Padmasambhava, inviting him. So the king sent off, got a message to Padmasambhava, inviting him to come and see if he could do what Shantarakshita, this gentle, saintly person, couldn't do. And Padmasambhava is the great transformer of energies, the great transformer of coarse energies. So instead of trying to ignore the sort of ingrained negative energies that opposed the Dharma, Padmasambhava got them on his side. In fact, he got them building the monastery alongside the human beings. Whereas Shantarakshita's approach perhaps had been to say, ooh, I don't like any of those, they're just nasty. Padmasambhava's approach was to get them on his side. So they built the monastery instead of knocking it down. And as you'll have seen last week, if you were here, this approach, getting our energies on our side, on the side of our Dharma practice, rather than having them working against it, is the essence of the Vajrayana. It's the essence of the Vajrayana approach, the tantric approach to the Dharma. So in the Vajrayana or tantric style of approach, we don't ignore our coarse energies and pretend they're there and they're not there. So we don't ignore our anger and say, I'm not an angry person. I'm not angry. We don't ignore our greed. You know, think, yeah, well, it's just occasionally I sort of binge on. We don't ignore it. We don't ignore our competitiveness, our envy, our pride, because these are energies we've all got. And we need to engage all our energy with our Dharma practice if we're going to get somewhere. So we need to not to just ignore and pretend these energies aren't there. We need to find ways to transmute them. We need to find ways to get them on our side, to get them working for us, get them working for the Dharma, get them working for our own liberation. And this approach to practice is very much what Padmasambhava represents and what the Vajrayana represents, this approach of transmuting energies, getting even our coarse energies working for us. So Padmasambhava successfully introduced Buddhism to Tibet. He built the monastery at Samye. But in fact, he only spent quite a short amount of time in Tibet. In his short stay, he had an extraordinary impact. He had a huge impact. But he couldn't transform the Tibetan people, transform the Tibetan culture in one go. He wasn't there that long. And it's often said, I have to say by Tibetans, that before the Dharma arrived there, before Buddhism arrived there, Tibetans were barbaric, warlike, violent, ignorant, etc., etc., etc. So you're going into quite a sort of difficult environment. A very warlike, rough place. And maybe some of the Tibetans were ready to hear the Dharma in the form of glamorous tantric practices. But it would be some time before many of them were ready for the more advanced aspects of the Dharma, like living a simple ethical life, being generous, thinking more about others. That was going to take a little bit of time. So the Tibetans weren't ready for all that Padmasambhava had to teach them. And if he was going to have to make a lasting impact, he had to find a way to continue his influence into future generations, into the future. He had to find a way to teach future generations when people had been practicing the Dharma for longer, were ready for a higher, more difficult message, if you like. So according to tradition, Padmasambhava solved this problem by hiding teachings all over Tibet with the help of his consort, Yeshe Sogyal. So they together, they hid teachings that were destined to be recovered when the Tibetans were ready to hear them, when the time was ripe. And these hidden teachings are called termas. Terma, or treasure. That means literally treasure, or buried treasure, something like the special name for the sort of treasure that pirates put a cross on the map for. And someone who finds these treasures is called a terton, a treasure finder. And these termas have been very important in the development of Buddhism in Tibet. And the FWBO has got a strong link with the Terma tradition because it's mainly associated with the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, which we haven't got on the board, but anyway, there are several different schools of Buddhism in Tibet. The Nyingma means the old ones, and they're the sort of direct descendants of Padmasambhava. They see themselves as the direct descendants of Padmasambhava. And they're the ones who really make the most of the Terma tradition. And Sangharakshita, most of Sangharakshita's Tibetan teachers when he was in Kalimpong were from that tradition. Those were the ones he sort of related to most, with the single exception of Dado Rinpoche. And one of his most distinguished teachers, the teacher who gave him the Manjigosha practice, which he passed on to many of his disciples, Jamyang Kensei Chokyi Lodro, was a spiritual descendant of one of the greatest tertons I think it had been his two generations before or something. So this is, you know, they're important to us. They're important to us in the FWBO. So the Terma tradition is important to Tibetan Buddhism. It's important to us. Now, the most famous Terma in the West is the so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Tadol. I'll explain a little bit about that, what that means later. And that's the one I'll focus on later in this talk. Another famous or well-known Terma is the Book of Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness, which describes a sort of basic aspect of Buddhist meditation, really. Just observing your thoughts and feelings without getting caught up with them, without identifying with them. As though they were mental weather. So you liberate yourself, as it were, even from the contents of your own mind. There are many, many other termas as well, which many of which describe aspects that seem pretty basic Buddhism, some of which are about very complex visualization practices. They're all sorts. So it's a vast tradition. Now, we could see this terma tradition. It's a sort of as a mythic description. We could see it as a mythic description of the way the tradition develops, the way the tradition needs to develop. And this isn't the only example of this sort of thing in Buddhism. For example, there's the tradition that Nagarjuna, the great philosopher Nagarjuna, had to go down to the depths of the ocean to receive the perfection of wisdom teachings from the Nagas, the creatures of the depths. So he had to go down to the depths to get this teaching from the creatures of the depths, who'd been guarding it until humanity was ready for it. Well, there's the tradition that Asanga was taught the Yogacara teachings, the teachings of vast activity, by the future Buddha Maitreya, who was currently dwelling in a sort of heaven realm, a higher realm, which Asanga managed to visit in his deep meditation. So you've got these other traditions in Buddhism where an advanced practitioner links into a stream of energy, perhaps you could see it like that, links into a stream of spiritual energy, links into a source of wisdom which is beyond their own through their meditation practice, in deep meditation. So this has given rise to this vast body of terma literature. And there are lots of different sorts of termas. So some are called earth termas, and earth termas tend to be buried in the ground. So they're in caves, or they're under rocks, or they're buried in the floor of caves, something like that. And then there are sky termas. There's a case of one which plummeted like a meteorite through the roof of a palace. And then there are mind termas, which Padmasambhava implanted in the minds of his original 25 disciples to mature in their later rebirths. So when the time was right, they would think, I suddenly seem to know this. So earth termas seem to be the most common. The buried treasure seems to be the most common. But termas are, in a sense, all mind termas, because to be a terton, to discover the termas, you have to be an advanced practitioner who somehow had the seed of understanding planted in you. It's not just like Joe Bloggs can just go out and, it's a terma. It doesn't work. You've got to actually be an advanced practitioner before you can find a terma. So because of that, earth termas usually seem to be written in Dakini script, which not everybody knows. So Dakinis, for those that don't know, means something like sky dancer. And Dakinis are wild, naked, dancing female figures who represent spiritual liberation, energy, freedom, all sorts of things. So if a normal person sees a terma written in Dakini script, they see beautiful dancing letters that seem to change, coloured light that seems to change, melt before their eyes. They can't make head or tail of it. Means nothing. So you've got to really be something before you even know what they're saying. So the typical story, so I'll give you a sort of typical story of the discovery of a termer, an earth termer. Might run something like this. One day, an advanced practitioner of the Dharma, who has practiced the Dharma in former generations, so he's got a link with the truth of it, and perhaps was even one of Padmasambhava's original 25 disciples. One day, such a person has a one night, probably, because he's probably not having a siesta at the time. One night, such a person has a memorable, bright, archetypal dream. And in this dream, a Dakini appears to him. Him or her, although I don't know of any women, I don't know why. Maybe there are. There are. Well, there are some. Anyway, appears to him or her. A Dakini appears to him or her. A beautiful, naked, wild, dancing woman. And she leads the dreamer to a cave. Leads the dreamer up into the hills, up into the mountains, to a cave. And indicates a place on the floor or a rock or something like that. And when the dreamer wakes up, they realize that this dream was very, very meaningful. They've got that sense that you sometimes have, oh, I remember that dream, that meant something. And they remember, oh, I know where that was. So they think, okay, this is a sign. I must go and dig where that Dakini point. So they get an expedition together. They get some yaks, perhaps, and some, you know, various things and some food, and they go off into the mountains to look for the cave. And they look for the cave, and eventually they find just the cave that the Terton saw in his dream, him, his or her dream. And they go and he says, that's about the place. He or she says, that's about the place. And they dig. And they dig. Boonk! A spade hits something. So, they clear around it, and lo and behold, there's a chest. There's a beautifully carved chest, or a chest of precious metal with beautiful designs on it. And they take it out, and they reverently open the chest, and a heavenly fragrance, the fragrance of a heavenly realm, fills the cave. And they're really excited. And what there seems to be in this chest is either a Tibetan-style book or some scrolls. And they think, well, it must be amazing. What's going to be this? And they can't make head or tail out of it. So the Terton, who's had the dream, looks at it, and it's just, oh, my eyes. It must be snow blindness. I don't know, coming up here. It's just this colourful, dancing figures that they see. They can't understand this at all. So disappointed, you know, we've come all this way. It seems like the whole expedition was a waste of time. Can't understand what this is about. All we use is a few gobbledygook scrolls and a bit of incense, you know. Put it back in the chest, put it on a yak, take it back down the mountain. Put it in the back room, up in the attic. Forget about it. Back to the normal thing. But then sometime later, the Terton will have another dream. And in the dream, again, the same Dakini will appear. The same dancing, naked female figure will appear. And she'll say, come and take them to the chest. And open the chest and give the scroll. And the person will look at the scroll. And in the dream, they will understand the teaching. They'll read the teaching. And they can read the text. And they read it through. And they know that something really important, something that is really timely and it really needed right now in this scroll. And they'll seem to understand the whole thing. And then the dream will fade, and they'll wake up and they'll sort of think, oh, a dream, it would be nice, wouldn't it? It would be nice if I really could understand it. But just to see, they'll go and sort of have a look. And, woo! As they pick the scroll up and look at it, they'll remember the meaning of what they dreamed. They'll remember the teaching, and they can read the script. So immediately, just in case this is a passing phenomenon, they sit down and they transcribe it into Tibetan script so that they can understand it. So they sit down, they write this all out in Tibetan. Whew, it's amazing. It's amazing. So then they'll, obviously, what would you do? You go and get a spiritual friend. You go and get somebody who you admire. And you show them this. And there are even cases where the person they've showed it to, apparently, according to tradition, has been rather sceptical and thought, and sort of set them a test. Set them the test of, well, okay, if you're not making this up, if you're reading this, you should be able to, I'll take your transcription away. You should be able to write it out again, word for word, from if you're reading it. And the person has, lo and behold, sat down and written it out. And then the sceptic has compared it with the other one, and it's the same. Anyway, so that's a sort of typical story of the finding and of a termer. And there have also been cases of tertons who've lost the ability to read their script, lost the ability to read their termer. If they've allowed their meditation practice to lapse, or they've fallen into unskillful ways, or they've lost their sort of edge, they'll pick up their termer one day and it's gobbledygook again. They can't read it. Which maybe says something about wisdom and how we know things. We have to be in a good state to know things. So, as I said, the best known, that's a little bit about termers in general. I mean, I think they're quite fascinating. They're sort of very romantic, archetypal things, this whole idea of termers and tertons. The best known termer in the West is the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is Bada Todol. It actually means something like Book of Liberation through Hearing in the In-Between State. The in-between state, in this case, being the state between death and the next birth. So bardo is an in-between state. It's a gap. It literally means something like a gap, an in-between place. So the bardo todol is all about what you should do in the gap between death and rebirth. But there are also other bardos. That's not the only bardo that there is. There is the bardo of dreaming. There is the bardo of meditation. There are lots of other bardos. And it's also stressed that this life itself is a bardo. This life itself is a gap between one state and another. It's called the bardo of everyday life. And every moment is a bardo. Every moment is a gap between what the past has made us and what we could be in the future. It's an intermediate state, a place where there are choices to be made, a place is where the past is going to exert a pressure, but there are choices to be made about the future. So this life is a bardo. So it's not the only bardo. This bardo between life, between death and the next rebirth. But the Bardo Todol, so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead, is specifically about this bardo between death and rebirth. And what it is, if you read it, it's a detailed technical description of what you might experience in the after-death state, with instructions about what you should do. The description of this state draws very, very heavily on Tibetan archetypal figures, tantric mandalas that only a Tibetan would be familiar with, and Tibetan ideas about medicine and how the body works. So it draws on all of that. And different bits are meant to be read out at specific times to the dead person. The dying or dead person, as a reminder of what they should be doing in the bardo, when they're likely to be confused and frightened, very confused and frightened. So the idea is that you hear a friendly, familiar voice telling you the meaning of what you're experiencing when you're experiencing this wacky stuff in the after-death state, and telling you what to do to use the opportunity that you've got and not sort of fall to a lower state because of your terror and confusion. So the bardo is seen as an opportunity to gain enlightenment, to break free from samsara, but it also carries the risk of being reborn in a lower state, a state of perhaps very unpleasant state indeed, as we shall see. So that's what the Bardo Todol is all about. It's a very technical, detailed book of instructions, that isn't going to mean a lot to someone who hasn't been pretty much steeped in the Tibetan Trantic tradition. And as such, it's really surprising to me that there's so much interest in it in the West. On the face of it, it is one of the termas which is least applicable to our current practice. Yeah? To us and our practice here and now, on the face of it. I personally, having come across it, have just sort of thought, well, yeah, so, great. I personally doubt very much whether someone who wasn't steeped in Tibetan culture and tantric tradition would see exactly these visions after death. I think that's very doubtful, myself. Different Buddhist traditions see the whole thing very differently. It goes on for a different length of time, etc., etc., etc. And we will not have a friendly lama reading the Bardo Tadol to us 49 days after our death, because we will be buried by then or cremated. So its very use is not very relevant to us. We just won't have that. So why? So my initial reaction when I was thinking about this talk, I was going to sort of present some teachings from a terma, and my initial reaction was that the Bardo Tadol, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, was the very last one that I was going to talk about because it was the least applicable to our practice here and now. But then I read it again. And I realized that although all the details of all the after-death visions and different colored lights and the different sort of this and that, I know all this was very specific and very technical and not likely to be a general experience. The basic experience that was being described, that was being experienced, was simple and universal. The basic experience underlying all these was simple and universal. So the basic principle that underlies all this stuff and is in fact very applicable to our practice here and now. So the basic principle is just as applicable to our practice here and now in the Bardo of this life as it is in the Bardo of the after-death state. So if we can stand back and not look at the trees but look at the wood, we can see that what this text is getting at is presenting something very generally applicable and something that we can apply here and now, although it's presenting it with lots of psychedelic coloured lights. So over and over again in the Bardo Tadol, the same thing happens. Over and over again, the dead person is offered a choice. This choice is sort of visualized by two lights. They see two lights, and they see two directions they could go in. Like two lights they could be attracted towards. And one light is clear and bright. It may seem blinding. It may seem painfully blinding. It may seem as sharp as a sword. Scary, threatening, not at all comfortable. It may even come accompanied by terrible rumbles of thunder. And this is the light of reality, the light of enlightenment. And another light is hazy and soft and smoky and dull and cozy, and it seems familiar and comforting. And it gives us pleasure. And this is the light of our habitual patterns, our habitual lower states, the patterns we are used to, our old habits, our old distractions, our old ways of being. So over and over again, the dead person experiences this in different forms, this contrast between the clarity, scary clarity, and sort of soft, smoky, pleasant, cozy comfort. And over again, the dead person is told to go for the scary, clear light. The light that leads to reality, dharmata, the nature of things, enlightenment. Over and over again, the dead person is told, no, no, don't go for that light that seems cozy and dull and safe and pleasurable. The light that seems to give pleasure, that's the light that leads down to lower states of being, your old habitual states of being. And this is presented, as I said, in a very sort of psychedelic, dramatic way, with all sorts of colours and things like that. But that is what's presented over and over again, is that choice. And of course, this is exactly the choice that we are being offered in the bardo between every moment and the next. In the bardo of this life, we're constantly being offered the choice between behaving as the person we could be and the person we are used to being. So we're constantly offered that choice. We're constantly being offered the choice to step out bravely into the unknown, into space, into light, into possibilities of what we could be, or going back to the cozy, comfortable, dim, rather smelly hole that we're used to living in. So the principle is exactly the same. I mean, it might come with psychedelic coloured lights in the Bardo Todol, but it's exactly the same principle. That we are confronted with every moment. So I like to sort of think about this of, I've got all this stuff comes from the past, which makes me feel like this, it makes me feel like that, makes me want this, makes that pleasurable to me. What would it be like if a Buddha, an enlightened being, sort of parachuted down into my body, and I had their experience, or they were having my experience, so they would think, oh yes, I really fancy that cream cake. I really fancy sitting down and watching Wimbledon all day on the telly. That sounds nice and comfortable thing to do. And the Buddha, the being who'd parachuted down into my body, would think, well, yeah, but I'm not going to do that. That's just a sort of thing from the past, isn't it? I'm going to do something new and different. I'm not saying that watching Wimbledon is inherently that unskillful, but the point I'm trying to make is we've all got that possibility of, you know, we could use this as a sort of thought experiment. What would a Buddha do if they were me, parachuted suddenly down into this body and thought, oh, well, I'm going to have to make the best of what I've got with the conditioning that this person's got already? Yeah, we can do that. And that's going to be frightening, because that some of the choices that Buddha would make will be truly scary. Truly, truly scary. Or am I just going to do the familiar things? Which actually, this Buddha who's parachuted into me is going to think, blimey, I'm doing that. That's smelly. That's old and stale and stuck. So it's a bit like that. We've constantly got this choice between behaving like the Buddha we could be, the enlightened being we could be, or being like the person we usually are, which is going to feel a load more cozy and comfortable. And pleasant. So anyway, that's the basic choice that's presented in the Bardo Todol, and it's presented over and over again. So in the Bardo Todol, it's presented in a particular form. The cozy, pleasant lights that the dead person sees after death lead to one of the six traditional realms of the Wheel of Life, which some of you will be very familiar with and some of you won't at all. But these are traditional realms that are illustrated on the Wheel of Life. They're both places that we can be reborn, sort of realms in which we can be reborn, but they are really states of being. They're states of being. The realm is a manifestation of the inner state. So we're reborn into these different realms in Buddhism. These are the choice that the person after death is making. We're reborn into these different realms, not as some sort of punishment for our karma, a wrong understanding of karma, but just because that's the sort of person we're used to being. If we're a particular sort of person, particular sort of being, we'll manifest in a particular sort of world. So the being in the dead person in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Bardo Todol, sees the cozy lights sort of drawing them towards these different realms, and also at the same time sees the light of a sort of corresponding Buddha figure, an archetypal Buddha figure who in some way is the antidote to going towards that realm. And the realms that are seen, the realms on the Wheel of Life, for those of you who don't know them, I'll just quickly sort of sum them up. There's the hell realm. Now, it's not somewhere you sent as a punishment, but it's the place that thoughts of anger, resentment, blame lead you to. It's a place of extreme mental distress, extreme mental suffering, intense negative mental states. There's the realm of the hungry ghosts, a realm of constant craving that can never be satisfied. Hungry ghosts got tiny mouths and huge bellies, and everything they eat and drink turns into sores in their throat. So it's the state of addiction, of constant craving that can never be satisfied, constant wanting. Then there's the animal realm, a dull, unthinking state with no sort of foresight, no culture or learning. There's the human realm, the familiar mixture that we know. There's the realm of what are called the Asuras, A-S-U-R-A-S, or Titans, the realm of big competitive egos, seeing life, a realm of battle, a realm where life is a battle for status, position, power. And then there's the God realm, life, a life of unchallenging pleasure and no effort, and no awareness of impermanence, which might sound very nice, but unfortunately it ends. So this might be the life of anyway, some people manage perhaps to live in a God realm for a while, life of undemanding pleasure, but it ends, and then the ex-God suffers even more because they develop no robustness, no ability to put up with adversity. So the inevitable adversity of all the other realms just seems terrible to them. So these are six sort of states, if you like, six states that you can actually meet people. I was in hospital recently. We were talking about this in our chapter night because I said, there were people from every single one of these realms in the ward that I was in. There was even some poor guy who was absolutely in hell, and really, there was everybody. There was a guy who was hugely, I won't go into it, but anyway, there were people from all of these realms. These are people are like this. People, you know, we all inhabit some of these realms some of the time. They're not just places that we get reborn. We've probably all spent time in all of them. And some of them will really attract us. Some of them will be really like, oh, I want that one. I like that one. That's really nice, like cozy. So in a way we're choosing them, and the dead person is choosing them, and we're choosing them. Why do we choose them? So why on earth do we choose states which are actually causes of suffering? They're actually states of suffering. It tells us in the Bhada Tadala, actually, it says we choose them because of habit energy, because of ingrained habit energy. Even if we know it's a state of suffering, we're drawn towards it because it's what we're used to. And it seems cozy and comfortable. And the opposite seems frightening. So, we haven't really got time to look at all of these realms, but one of the principles in the Bhada Tadal is that you're drawn towards one of these realms. The object, incidentally, is to not be reborn in any of these realms, but to break free entirely. From conditioned existence. But we're drawn towards one of these realms. And if we keep going down, 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 it gets worse and worse, and everything gets frightening and frightening. But at the same time as we experience the sort of pull of these realms, we experience the influence of a Buddha. So we start out, we just see the clear light of reality and we're absolutely petrified. Get me out of here. But over time, that sort of becomes a bit more human. It becomes like the lights of particular Buddha, particular archetypal Buddhas who offer us an alternative. And the alternative is the sort of antidote. So, for example, we might be called by the soft, smoky, white light of the hell realm. We might actually quite like our indignation and our blame. I mean, I like feeling like that. So we're called towards that. At the same time, we'll experience the clear, bright light of Akshobhya, the Buddha of wisdom, the Buddha of the Vajra. So anger, blaming, resentment leads to that hell state. But there's a connection between that and what's called the mirror-like wisdom of Akshobhya, which sees everything exactly, bing, precisely as it is. So if we are like that, we need to stop blaming others for our pain. Stop resenting others. And we use the energy that we put into that, the energy of anger, as a sword to cut through our delusion. Yeah? We need to see that our pain is caused by our delusion and use the clarity of our, the clarity of that energy. There's somehow a connection between anger and clarity. I always think that's why scholars are such a combative lot. Always arguing with each other. So there's somehow a connection. And this is sort of embedded in the tantric tradition. There are sort of personality types who are drawn, or they're energies that are drawn in a particular way, but they carry in a way their own antidote with them. So if it's anger, then go for wisdom. See it as it is. Get that anger against your delusion. But if it's the soft yellow light that leads to the realm of the hungry ghosts that's calling you. Cream cakes. Bottle of beer. Place of, you know, calling towards your sort of distracting yourself with crisps and desires and wanting and shopping and this and that. If it's the hungry ghost realm that's calling, we need to transmute our passion and desire. And the clear red light of Amitabha, the Buddha of love, transmutes passion and desire into passionate metta, passionate concern for others, passionate compassion. There's somehow a connection between wanting, desire, and warm passion for others. So we need to sort of work on warm love for others, passion for others. If it's the soft blue light of pride which is calling us, apparently it doesn't quite work, the associations don't all quite work, but if the soft blue light of pride is calling us, we need to contact the generative power of generosity. We need to see us be proud of what we can contribute. So we need to contact the energy of Ratnasambhava, the jewel Buddha, golden Buddha, who sort of shines like a summer sun, ripening everything around him, giving everything around him. He's got his hand in a gesture of generosity. He's giving out. That's what we need to connect with. If pride is what we're about, we need to sort of be about giving. If we're attracted to the realm of envy, the realm of the, if our sort of envy and insecurity and competitiveness attract us to the realm of the asuras, where we're going to go out and prove ourselves, show how big we are, get loads of status, beat the other guy, beat the other woman, have loads of nice big car, and have everybody call me sir, thank you. If that's what we're going for, then we need to connect with the clear green light of the Buddha Amoghasiddhi, is about action. Is about action. If we take action, if we're active in others' behalf, not just in our own, then well, it ceases to be about, you know, we cut through this sort of insecurity that leads us to the realm of the asuras. I'm not going to say anything about the gods because I haven't got time. But so, in each case, there's a sort of soft, cozy light which calls us to a lower state, and a rather harsh, penetrating light, sometimes with thunder, which seems a bit, which calls us in the opposite direction. And for some reason, well, because of habit energy, we often spend our lives choosing the sort of one that will lead us to a state that isn't actually very pleasant. It might just be boring. Might actually be very painful. But it's amazing how we go for what we were used to, instead of sort of stepping out into this rather scary light. So that choice is always there. That choice is always there. It's there in the bardo. It's illustrated by these different sort of lights that you go in the direction of in the bardo after death. But it's there. It's here now as well. More importantly for us, it's here now. We can choose. We're choosing every moment. Every moment is a bardo in which... we have a choice between something which may seem unfamiliar and scary and a bit too clear for our liking, and something which is going to seem comfortable and cozy because it's actually what we're used to. But if we keep going with what we're used to, we're in downward spirals. Because if you keep becoming more what you're used to, you end up in a big, deep rut that you can't get out of at all. Whereas if we keep stepping out into something rather scary, of being a different sort of person, being the person we could be, then, well, really the sky's the limit. Change makes more change, and all sorts of possibilities open up. So that's what the Bardo Tadol is all about. And that's why, in fact, it is relevant to us, and not just if you happen to be dead.